Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and today we're going to continue reading from the ELM. Today we get into the 600s, and those are all about employee relations. There are some provisions in here that are often cited in discipline, and like all of this stuff, there are things in here that management is supposed to be doing and things for which they're supposed to be held accountable, and we need to do a good job of holding them accountable. Before we get started, this episode comes out a little bit late. If you don't listen to them right when they come out, then it doesn't much matter. But I have been on vacation. I took the hiking group that I organized to Mesa Verde National Park in Colorado, and it was awesome. We put together a bus trip, stayed at the group campsite, and it went really, really well. So that's why I've been incommunicado for a while. But I'm back on it, and it's time to start releasing episodes again. So, with no further ado, let's get right into it. We start with 611 Scope. Service programs help employees understand their jobs better and eliminate many distractions caused by personal job-related problems. Employees are encouraged to ask supervisors or officials for advice or assistance on important matters, even if unrelated to business. Do you have that kind of relationship with your supervisors that you can ask them for advice or assistance, even if it's unrelated to business? Dude, I feel like I can barely ask them about things that are related to business. I do, though. I do ask them, like, hey, what's the policy? Like, here's a good one to ask your supervisor. When a certified letter is being returned to sender, does it need a signature, or can I just put it in the mailbox? There's not an easy answer to this one. I've done a lot of digging on that, and as near as I can tell, everything that the customer sees about certified letters and what that service is it provides proof of delivery or of attempted delivery. That's it. That's what it pays for. So when you go to the recipient's house and you knock, knock, knock on the door, they either sign for it or they refuse it or it's not attempted, not known, or whatever it is, that's it. That is the end of what that certified letter is paying for. And there is nothing that I could find in the domestic mail manual about having to scan it and get a signature upon its return to sender. I don't think that part of the journey is paid for with that certified service. But it's not super clear, or at least in the information that I was able to find, is not super clear. So that's a really good question for your supervisor. And of course, whatever your supervisor tells you, whether it's right or wrong, that becomes the policy until you hear or can prove otherwise. By the way, if you definitively know the answer to that question, if you know where it is in the DMM or in some other manual, please send it to me because I really want the definitive answer to that question. That comes up on social media all the time where people will ask, hey, I really need to know what the answer is. And people will say, well, in my office, we just put them in the mailbox. Well, that's not the definitive answer. Your office could be doing it wrong. What it says in the DMM or whatever covers certified mail, that's the definitive answer. All right, moving on. Let's get to some more definitive answers. 612.2, methods. 612.21, official directives. Major subject manuals are the basic source documents outlining Postal Service operational policies. Postal bulletins, management instructions, handbooks, memorandums of policy, etc., instruct, explain, or detail the implementation of a specific policy or regulation. So here it is in the ELM that says, like all of our manuals, like the M39, the M41, all the M documents, everything like that, even what it says on bulletins, all of that defines policy. All of that defines the way we're supposed to do our job. So Article 19 of the National Agreement makes all of those things citable, but so does this part of the ELM, 612.21. Even the ELM that we're reading right now falls under this provision. Next, 612.22, unofficial communications. Newsletters, memos, etc. are communications used for information only. 612.23, bulletin boards. 612.231, utility and convenience. Bulletin boards serve as a means of providing to employees information of interest, such as that required by law or regulation, official management information, and items of general interest. Bulletin boards are to be placed in sufficient numbers and in locations convenient to employees at or near employee entrances, lunchrooms, locker rooms, or elsewhere in the work area. It is useful to separate board space into broad categories for different types of materials, such as A, required by law or regulation. Required material that tends to be permanent includes notices about 1. Local fire emergency plan, 2. OSHA poster 2203, 3. OWCP Office of Workers' Compensation Programs, 4. Unemployment Compensation Protection for Federal Employees, and 5. Equal Employment Opportunity. B. Official management use. Items that should be dated and removed when outdated include notices about 1. Job opportunities, 2. Benefit plans, 3. Events affecting working conditions, 4. Changes in work schedules, and 5. Changes in wage rates. And then C. General interest. General interest material includes notices about 1. Lost and found items, 2. Social and recreational events, 3. Blood donor programs, 4. Food price changes, 5. Public transportation schedules, 6. Meetings, 7. Combined federal campaign, 8. Parking regulations, and 9. Housing. So all of these are things that you may find in the bulletin boards, on the bulletin boards at your station. Next, 612.232, suitability. Only suitable material should be posted on bulletin boards. It is the responsibility of the installation head to ensure the appropriate use of bulletin boards. In addition to providing bulletin board space for management use, the installation head must provide bulletin board space for union use consistent with the terms of the applicable collective bargaining agreement. All right, so there should be a bulletin board for your union specifically, where you can put up your own notices and things like that. Next, 612.24, employee lockers. 612.241, issuance. Whoop, hold on, I just scrolled accidentally here. Let me get back to it. Here we go. Issue personnel PS Form 4943 locker record to assign employee lockers. Employees are required to sign the form to acknowledge that use of the locker by other persons or exchanging lockers without authority of the issuing office is prohibited. Upon separation or transfer, employees must return their locker key to the appropriate facility official. You know, at my station, the lockers are very informal. When I got to that station, I just grabbed whatever locker was open and I put my stuff in there, and none of them lock. So we provide our own padlocks and put those padlocks on the lockers, and that's how the lockers are handled. Apparently, they're supposed to be handled like this, which makes a lot more sense, that they should be like officially assigned so that you know whose locker is whose. Next, 612.242. Maintenance and inspection. Employee lockers are for official use only and must be kept clean and presentable. The use of personal locks is not permitted. Oh, well, there you go. See, I'm breaking the rules by using my own lock, but management doesn't provide locks. So what else am I supposed to do? I guess I could file a grievance on management for not providing locks. Employee lockers are subject to inspection by authorized personnel. Provisions governing locker inspections are provided in applicable collective bargaining agreements. 613, I'll just summarize what 613 is. It essentially says that we are allowed to have our own credit unions and that management should be cooperative if we have a credit union. 614, food services. All right, I found this one especially interesting, and I'm going to need your guys' help in interpreting some of these provisions here. 614.1, policy. The Postal Service provides food services, including provision of snacks and beverages that cannot be conveniently obtained at reasonable prices from commercial sources and that are required for the health, comfort, or efficiency of postal employees while on duty. The Randolph-Shepard Act, as amended in 1974, dealing with the operation of vending facilities by a blind vendor, applies to the Postal Service. 614.2, operation. 614.21, responsibility. Food service facilities in central lunchrooms and in satellite work areas, manual, vended, or a combination, are under the control of the installation head. This responsibility may not be designated to any employee or committee. 614.22. Employees should expend only minimal time and effort in food management. Therefore, these operations are contracted out to professional in-plant food management firms and concessionaires, including qualified food service operations established by state licensing agencies for the blind. So just to go over what we have so far, the installation head, like your postmaster, is responsible for your vending machines or whatever else you guys do for food service. And they're not to delegate that responsibility because employees should be dealing with other stuff and should just be able to go in there and get what food they need, and that's that. 614.3 types. As conditions warrant, an installation head may have three distinct types of food service operations. Subject to the provisions of the Randolph-Shepard Act, as amended in 1974, priority consideration is given to the state agency for the blind for the operation of any of the following food services. A. Central lunchroom or cafeteria. An employee lunchroom or cafeteria, either manual or vended, may be established to provide necessary food service to an installation's employees. Cafeterias are contracted for on a break-even basis to provide wholesome food at the lowest practical cost. All right, so just a little bit more on A. At the main processing plant at the PNDC here in Las Vegas, there is a lunchroom, and it's just vending machines. And the vending machines do have really reasonable prices. And so that's what this is about, right? You provide these vending machines, and you're not trying to rake the employees. It's a place to get us food, right? That's their purpose. All right, B, vending in work areas. Vending machines with snacks, beverages, tobacco products, etc. may be installed at or near employee workstations. So again, at our PNDC, we have vending machines that are kind of spread throughout the plant where people can, you know, pick up snacks or whatever, in addition to the main break room that has the microwaves and things like that. And C, blind vending facility. Food service and vending stands are established in postal facilities through arrangements with state licensing agencies for the blind. Every effort is made to cooperate with state licensing agencies to implement this program. As opportunities arise, postal officials notify state agencies of additional vending facilities to be operated by the blind under the Randolph-Shepard Act. So I guess we give preferential contracting to blind-owned and operated companies for our lunchroom vending. All right, so now you know. Next, 614.4, funds. A fee of 1.5% of net sales is paid to the Postal Service by all vendors operating under contract. This operating fee offsets utilities costs to the Postal Service. No operating fees or commissions are charged to blind vendors operating under permit. Okay, now we get to the really interesting part, at least to me. 615, Social Recreation Program. 615.1, before I get into this, remember that we just learned that the post office gets a fee of 1.5% of the net sales of whatever, like the vending machines, or whatever vendors are operating under contract. So whether it's people who come in and refill your vending machines, or whether you have an actual lunchroom with like workers there that the post office contracts out, 1.5% of those sales goes back to the Postal Service. So 615.1, policy. Management encourages employee social and recreational programs. These programs help ensure the mental and physical well-being of personnel and assist in recruiting and retaining employees. Oh, great. So they want us to have social and recreational programs. So here's where we get into it with the funding. 615.3, committees. 615.31, membership. The installation head organizes and chairs the committee. To ensure that all employees are fairly represented, the balance of the committee includes a representative from each craft designated by the unions representing those crafts and a member from supervision designated by the organization representing the supervisory employees. So, let me get do the next one here. 615.32, requirements. 615.321, income from vending operations. An employee social and recreational committee must be established in each installation where employees receive income from vending machines or other enterprises. This committee may not have management responsibilities for such vending operations. So in 614, it said that employees can't get income from these vending machines. You know what? Okay, I think I misinterpreted it the first time I read through these. All right, so we get 1.5%, and the post office gets that money, and then, so anywhere that the post office gets money from these vending machines or from food suppliers or whatever, then this committee is supposed to exist. This committee on social and for social, the social and recreational committee is supposed to exist. I have never heard of such a thing here in Las Vegas. If you have them where you work, please tell me about them. classesofmail@gmail.com. This is like total uncharted territory as far as I'm concerned. I feel confident that, like in my station, we recently switched over to a self-service convenience store, essentially, where there's, you know, all the food on racks like you'd have at a convenience store, and you just take it over to the scanner, scan it, and then pay for your item yourself, and it's all automated. So presumably, whoever put that vending system in is now paying rent to our station to be in there. Presumably, it's this 1.5%. Where is that money going? It's supposed to go to this social and recreational committee to do things for employees, and it'll get into what they're supposed to do with it coming up. Does this happen where you work? I'm really curious about it. classesofmail@gmail.com. 615.322, meetings and duties. Members of the Employee Social and Recreational Committee must be permitted by their supervisor to attend committee meetings called by the chairperson. They must also be permitted to perform duties relating to the functions of the committee while on the clock, subject at all times to the needs of the Postal Service. 615.33, responsibilities. The Employee Social and Recreational Committee represents all employees in the installation. It is responsible for administering social and recreational funds and administering programs for the benefit of all employees in the installation. The committee is specifically responsible for A. Receiving, safeguarding, dispersing, and accounting for employee social and recreational funds. Dude, I hate to keep digressing, but I have no idea who in my installation is on this committee or if such a committee even exists. I guess I'm going to have to ask down at the Union Hall what the story is with any of this stuff, if they even know. B, developing and publicizing well-rounded social and recreational programs that contribute to the benefit of all employees. No single individual, group, or organization may be permitted to 1. Attach its name as a sponsor of an activity or event financed and sponsored by the Social and Recreational Fund. 2. Use such events in any way for the furtherance of its organizational objectives. C. Expending employee social and recreational funds for the social and recreational activities of all employees. Again, these are the things that the committee is responsible for. No monies may accrue to the benefit of a single group, organization, or individual. D. Publishing annually the financial status of the Employee Social and Recreational Fund for the information of all employees. All right, so here's probably a place for me to start as a union steward, is I'll put in a request for information. Pursuant to 615.33D, I'd like to see the published financial status of the Employee Social and Recreational Fund. E. Advising the food service officer about the manner in which the vending operation and work areas is meeting employee needs and about pricing policies that should be established on vended items. 615.4, Employee Social and Recreational Fund. 615.41, Purpose. The fund provides a financial basis for the support of well-rounded social and recreational programs that benefit all employees of the installation. Again, is this happening? Do you have these programs where you work? Do you have vending machines where you work? Where is that money going? These are all good questions. 615.42, source of funds. Funds may be derived from the following sources. A, sale of non-alcoholic beverages, candy, cigarettes. Dude, we could still have cigarette vending machines. Can you imagine? Maybe you have that where you work. Hell, I don't know. And other consumable products by vending machines located in work areas under the following conditions. 1. Employee committees may not operate vending facilities. 2. The Postal Service contracts for vending services except for those operated under permit by the blind. So again, we would have a contract with the vendor. We get that 1.5%. But if it's one of those blind companies, then they just keep all the money. 3. Vending commissions are paid directly to the Postal Service except for income provided by the Postal Service to a state licensing agency for the blind under the Randolph-Shepard Act. All right. B, interest on savings accounts and other investments in U.S. savings bond or other securities. And C, proceeds Oh, proceeds from the sale to employees of tickets to dinners, picnics, parties, recreational activities, and discount merchandise and travel. All right, so again, this is where they get all these funds. 615.43, funds excluded. Monies received from the following operations are not employee social and recreational funds and are not to be included in the report in the records or reports. A, stands or vending machines operated by blind persons under permit. Again, the blind people just keep that money. B, funds from the operation of a cafeteria or lunchroom, including income from vending machines located in the operating areas of these eating facilities. I thought it said before that the lunchroom, the cafeteria, and vending machines would provide money for this fund. Now it says that these shouldn't be included. Funds from the operation of a cafeteria or lunchroom, including income from vending machines located in operating areas of these eating facilities. This is why I need your help, guys, interpreting this, because some of this stuff just sounds contradictory to me. I must not be reading it right. I don't know. C, coffee shared by a group of employees on a nonprofit basis. Yes, so that's fine. Everybody pitches in $5 and they get themselves a coffee pot and some coffee. That's not part of this funding system. D, honor systems where the money received covers only the cost of the items available. See, all the rest of these, it makes sense to me why those wouldn't be included in this fund. E, voluntary contributions such as those incident to the death or illness of fellow workers. F, donations or gifts from any source. These are in violation of the Code of Ethical Conduct and may not be accepted under any circumstances. G, proceeds from recycling projects. 615.452, single fund. The Employees Social and Recreational Committee is responsible for the proper safeguarding of employee social and recreational funds. All funds received throughout a postal installation must be turned over to the employee designated to handle such funds. Only one fund may be maintained for each postal installation. Separate funds may not be maintained by stations or branches. 615.47, expenditures of funds. 615.471, general benefit. Employees' social and recreational funds are for providing recreational and social activities for the benefit of all postal employees. Expenditures should not be made that will benefit only a single group, organization, or individual. You know what's a good example of this? Is here in Las Vegas, we have an event called the Corporate Challenge, where all these big companies will put together teams and they'll have like softball and track and field and like air hockey and ping pong and all these different tournaments, like athletic competitions that these different corporations participate in, and there are entry fees. So something like that, you know, it would be open post office wide where employees could participate in track and do all these different things. And this fund, this social and recreational fund, would cover the cost of entry, if such a thing exists here. Next, 615.472, appropriate expenditure. There are many types of expenditures that may properly be made that will be for the benefit of all the employees. Questions relating to the appropriateness of intended expenditures should be referred to the district manager. Contributions to the following types of projects would be appropriate expenditures for the Employee Social and Recreational Committee. A, gift to an employee or wife of an employee for a new baby, provided the same criteria are used for all employees. So I guess there'd be some policy that if you have a baby, then this fund will give you 2 boxes of diapers. B, retirement gift for an employee, provided the same criteria are used for all employees. So when you finally get up to 75 years old and you get to retire, we will give you 2 boxes of diapers because you probably need them by now. C, expression of sympathy for a death in the immediate family, provided the same criteria are used for all employees. There you go. Somebody dies, we give you 2 boxes of diapers. I don't know, guess whatever, at least a sympathy card, some flowers, whatever. D, an annual party, picnic, or other outing for all employees. E, seasonal and holiday non-sectarian decorations. F, sports programs. Oh, there you go. That would be like the Corporate Challenge sports program. G, recreational activities available for all employees. Like maybe they put a batting cage out at the PNDC where employees can go and, you know, hit some balls. G, oh, I already said that. recreational activities. H, scholarships for children of postal employees, provided the same criteria are used for all employees' children. I, microwave ovens, refrigerators, games, and recreational equipment for the swing room. At the main PNDC, the post office provides those microwaves, the post office provides the ice machine, but at our own stations, we've had to scrounge for that stuff. And this is what that money is supposed to be used for. All right, next section is 617, and that covers the combined federal campaign. If you're interested in that, by all means, check out section 617. Now, section 620, contests. 622, objective. Contests are intended to provide a motivational tool for improving performance in particular functions. Such programs can be used for, but are not limited to, safety awareness and sales promotion. Each contest must have a specific start and end date, and the purpose must be clearly defined. Section 623 essentially just lays out that upper management is who is in charge of these contests. 624, establishment. 624.1, criteria, responsible officials. A, establish clear objectives, guidelines, and rules in advance. B, specify start and end dates. C, structure the contest to make it competitive. If individual competition is involved, at least 10 employees must be included. D, establish objectives that are clear and measurable. So I took part in a contest like this a while back. It was a postal version of Shark Tank, where they wanted rank and file employees, like craft employees, to come and present their ideas for how we could improve the postal service. And I presented an idea that actually wound up winning the competition. And my idea, they said, you know, it was the best idea they heard and it would be very simple to implement. And yeah, this is great. And then they never did it. Very typical of the postal service. All right, 626, types of award. Oh, let me tell you what it was real quick, because maybe you can do something like this in your area and they'll actually implement it, because there's no denying it was a great idea because it won the contest. Whenever new procedures roll out, there's always resistance from employees that they just don't want to do it. Like when load truck first rolled out, people were opposed to it. It's a waste of time. And maybe that's true. Maybe it is a waste of time. But inevitably, at the morning stand-up, the supervisor is just reading from a memo that says, hey, this new program is rolling in. And then when employees have questions about it, the supervisors just answer with blank stares, and I don't know, because they're just reading the memo, and it's probably the first time they've ever heard of it, too. So my suggestion was that when new policies and procedures are rolled out, that we should use the instructors from the Carrier Academy to go from station to station and teach these new procedures. Like when there's changes to the scanner, you know, I had that whole episode about things about the scanner that you didn't, or scanner features nobody told you about. How nice would it be to have somebody from the Carrier Academy come out and like walk you through all these new things that your scanner can do? And it solves a couple of problems. Number one, supervisors are not teachers, and often they don't even know the material. Number two, people have an inherently confrontational relationship with their supervisors that they wouldn't have with Carrier Academy instructors, because we're one of them. You know, we're craft employees just like them. And so since they're already paying Academy instructors to train people, why not just use Academy instructors to train people when these new things come out? So yeah, the postmaster, our local postmaster, thought that was a kick-ass idea and the best idea in the contest. And then they never did it. All right. 626, types of awards. 626.1, acceptable. Acceptable awards are characterized as follows. A, only non-cash items such as trophies, plaques, pins, or gift certificates may be awarded. B, the value of each award may vary from contest to contest or be graduated within a contest with progressive levels of competition. C, to ensure maximum interest, prizes should be alternated periodically, or a variety of prizes should be made available for individual selection from a catalog. D, prizes offered must be appropriate for both sexes. And E, the maximum value of a contest award cannot exceed $500. You know, this is just like the award section from back, I think it was in the 400s, that they have all these rules laid out, and oh, this is the kind of competitions you can have, and these are the prizes you can give, and when's the last time you saw prizes? Even with that Shark Tank thing that I did, I don't recall there actually being a prize. I think it was just, if you're good enough, we'll implement your idea. And it turned out they wouldn't do that either. All right, 627, limitations. 627.1, numbers and types of contests. The following guidelines apply. A, sponsoring organizations may conduct no more than 4 contests per year. And oh, that's funny. In my own notes here, I wrote that it's probably about as useful as the rules in the 490s that limit how many awards an employee can be given. Yeah, we're not running into the problem of doing too many of these things. B, identical contests may not be carried over automatically from year to year. And C, approval must be received before each contest, even if it is similar or identical to a previously authorized contest. Next, we get to 640, employee claims, and that is claims of damage or loss against the Postal Service, like if a untethered U-cart rolls through the parking lot and smashes into your car, and now you have a claim against the Postal Service. So there are all these provisions in the 640s about employee claims, but we have our own rules about that in our collective bargaining agreement, and 642 covers how you handle claims with bargaining unit employees. And it essentially says that it, whatever it says in their contract. So if you want to know more of that, I refer you to Article 27 of the National Agreement, which I conveniently read for you in a previous episode of Classes of Mail. Hopefully that episode was after I stopped doing the accents. Because man, listening back on those, oh, that makes me cringe. All right. 650. Non-bargaining, disciplinary, grievance, and appeal procedures. So this goes over how people who are not in a bargaining unit deal with grieving their discipline. And obviously this does not apply to us, so I'm not going to read it. I'll just say that having read it myself, I'm really glad that we have Article 16 of the National Agreement, because that protects our right a hell of a lot better than the ELM does. The next section is 660, conduct, and I think I'm going to save this for the next episode. This is ethical laws and the ways that we're supposed to behave and things like that, and it's going to merit a fair amount of discussion. So we're going to pick up with the next episode in the 660s, and thank you guys for listening. Please, again, if you do have that social and recreational fund or you know where your vending machine money is going, please send me an email, classesofmail@gmail.com. And I will catch you guys next time.